Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's International and National Security Law Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, May 26, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on recent developments involving Apple and the FBI. My name is Will Courtney, and I'm the Deputy Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Additionally, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, we welcome experts Gus Hurwitz and Jamil Jaffer. More complete bios are provided to you in the notice of the call, so I'll stop here and preserve more time for their presentations, followed by your questions. With that, Professor Hurwitz, the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you for the introduction, and thanks to everyone for joining us for this call. I want to start by saying that nothing I say on this call will be uncontroversial. This is a very controversial area, which is part of why it's so fascinating, and there's very little consensus on what the right answers are to these questions. So I'm going to start by giving a bit of background with what's been going on recently in these fights between Apple and the FBI. Then I'm going to take a step back and give a sense of the broader history that the contemporary fights fit into. Then I'm going to turn back to the specifics of what's been going on with Apple to really narrowly define how I think what this case is about. Then talk a bit about the purposes of encryption and the interesting pending issues. There's a interesting aspect to the framing of this call, which is that the pending litigation between Apple and the FBI, there were two cases. They have both been mooted at this point. The FBI has been able to get into the encrypted iPhone devices that it was seeking to have the courts compel Apple to help them obtain access to. So there is not currently pending litigation in either of those matters. However, that doesn't mean that this issue is going to go away anytime soon. So I'm going to focus primarily on the San Bernardino iPhone case, but I also want to mention a Eastern District of New York case that involved efforts by the FBI to obtain access to a drug dealer's Apple iPhone device. I'm going to start with that case because it's the facts are relatively simple. In that case, the government had obtained a drug dealer or a believed drug dealer's iPhone and wanted to obtain access to it. The device was encrypted. The way that this encryption works is there is a key, an encryption key that is contained in part on the file system, and it is also partially contained in the owner of the devices or the user of the device's head. That is, it is the PIN, the code that you enter to unlock the device. So you need to be able to have that PIN in order to unlock that device. And in the Eastern District of New York case, the government was seeking Apple's assistance to get access to bypass the need to have that PIN. What ultimately happened there is they found someone who knew the PIN and gave them access to that PIN, so they didn't need to seek Apple's assistance anymore. The San Bernardino case is the better known and more controversial case. This involves suspected terrorists or potential terrorists who engaged in a mass shooting, killing several people. They were killed in the incident, so they were no longer there in order to either protest on privacy grounds, compelling access to the device, or to have the government try and force them to provide the passcode, the PIN, to the device. So in this case, the FBI sought a order under the All Writs Act to compel Apple to modify the operating system running on the iPhone device in order to allow the FBI to do what's known as brute force the PIN. Brute forcing just means guessing every single possible pin and hoping that you get the right one. With the default Apple iPhone configuration for this model of phone, that was not a complicated task because the pin itself was most likely only 4 digits, which means there were only 10,000 possible codes to try, and that could be done manually in a number of days. So this was not a impossible task to do. The problem was Apple had implemented safeguards to prevent just that from being done. So with the iPhone device, each time that you enter a wrong PIN, a counter in the device is incremented, and the more times that you enter the PIN incorrectly, the longer you need to wait between each next guess. So you enter the PIN incorrectly 2 or 3 times, you need to wait 30 seconds. You enter it incorrectly a couple more times, you need to wait a couple of minutes. You enter it incorrectly another couple of times, and the device locks you out absolutely. There's another concern that the iPhone devices contain effectively a self-destruct function, which will erase all of the data, or more precisely, it will erase a encryption key contained on the device itself if you enter the PIN incorrectly 10 times. So what the FBI was seeking Apple's help with was rewriting the interface by which they would be able to access and enter potential PINs so that they could attempt to brute force the device. This case, too, was mooted because the FBI was able to get the help of a third-party security vendor. We don't know exactly who it was or a lot of the terms and details of the code that they were able to obtain, but likely as a result of the publicity of this case, the attention that this case drew to the FBI's need to get into the iPhone, a security consultant came to the FBI and said, hey, we can get you into the phone, just give us $500,000 or some amount of money, because the FBI was able to get into the device with without Apple's assistance, that mooted the issue. So let's take a step back and put this case into a broader history. This case fits into what's referred to as the crypto wars or the encryption wars. The crypto wars really started with the advent of modern encryption, modern computer-based encryption in the 1970s, as computers were moving from primarily the military domain to the civilian domain. The need to protect civilian data became increasingly pressing. So in the 1970s, we started to see encryption moving from the military to the civilian domain, just as computers were doing. Over time, this gave rise to a number of cases in the 1980s and especially the 1990s, which led the government to reclassify encryption from being a munition to being something of commercial utility. So it had previously been considered a munition, which subjected it to strict export controls, which made it very difficult for civilian applications to make use of strong encryption. That's no longer the case. So today, civilians are, broadly speaking, free to use and deploy strong encryption technologies for their own purposes. At the same time, the original use of encryption, we can say, was focused on data in place. Data in place means data that is stored on a device. At the same time, in the late 80s into the early 1990s, there was increasing concern about data in transit, that is telecommunications data, data being transferred over telephone networks, telecommunications networks, and that data was being encrypted. And this was frustrating FBI efforts to install and implement wiretaps. And this wasn't just about encryption at the time. This was also about the simple digitalization of data. Telephone switches were going from analog switches, where each conversation, each call was run over a dedicated pair of wires to one where all of the calls were multiplexed in digital form over a single pair of wires, which created difficult challenges from a Fourth Amendment minimization purpose perspective and a technological perspective. This gave rise to an important act known as CALEA, which we might get into a little bit. But it also gave rise to a large debate over the legality of encrypted communications. The government attempted to require something known as key escrow, where telecommunications providers that had encrypted communication systems had to give the government a copy of that key, the decryption key, which the government would hold in escrow. So if law enforcement needed to be able to obtain access to encrypted communications, they would be able to do that. This proved to be both controversial and technologically hard to implement. After a couple attempts to implement it were proven to be fundamentally flawed at a technological level, this approach was abandoned. The current state of the law in this area, looking to CALEA, this act that's Communications Assistance for Law Enforcement, is that telecommunications providers don't need to be able to decrypt user encrypted content. So end users are free to encrypt their content. There's no obligation that end users be compelled to decrypt it or that telecommunications providers not handle undecryptable data. Telecommunications providers are also free to deploy their own non-decryptable encryption, but telecommunications providers do need to assist law enforcement to the extent that they are able in decrypting user information. But there's a really important exception to this, which is telecommunications providers need to be able to provide the government with certain call information on a unencrypted basis. So the idea here was, at the time, you had multiple parties who would be very likely handling at least some of the data in unencrypted form. You had the end user who would typically be either communicating data in unencrypted form, storing data in unencrypted form, or the telecommunications provider would have some access to some of the data in unencrypted form. So law enforcement would always have access to some of the data in principle, at least on a probabilistic basis. Today, communications logic has been moving from the telecommunications infrastructure, the telecommunications switches, to the devices, to smartphones. So these modern smartphones are able to deploy what's known as end-to-end encryption. In end-to-end encryption, data is encrypted from the user side through the entire communications channel to the destination side. And all of this data is encrypted using a key that only the user knows. And what's more, these systems are turnkey, or they're increasingly turnkey. So the users don't need to be technological experts. They don't need to necessarily be concerned about the privacy or security of their communications. They just need to have a PIN, which modern devices require you to have in order for all their communications to be encrypted. So this has really changed the scale of the problem that law enforcement has been struggling with encryption for the last 30, 40 years, because it's now automatic and it's pervasive. It's end-to-end. So we need to start thinking, and we have been thinking, about these hard questions about how do we deal with encryption when it's being deployed at a massive scale. So I want to frame how I think about what Apple has been doing in this case, because it's different than the general understanding of what Apple has done or what this case is about. So the Apple device requires a PIN. I've mentioned that it defaults to four characters. That PIN is effectively your password. And I expect that everyone at this point understands that a four-digit password is a really, really bad password. no computer, no systems administrator would allow users to have by default a four-digit password. This is because it's really, really easy to guess a four-digit password if you have access to a device and a little bit of time. So a four-digit password is, frankly, bad security, but it's good usability. And back in the era of Steve Jobs, Apple was very willing to trade off security for usability. And in fact, most companies are willing to do this because this is what users want. In the post-Snowden world and under Tim Cook, however, Apple has turned to care much more about security for a number of reasons. So what they did is they changed the interface. They didn't change the underlying security, but they changed the interface to make it harder to brute force, to guess what the PIN is. The way that I describe this, or one of the ways I describe this, is Apple didn't make the lock more complicated. They didn't make it harder to pick the lock. Instead, what they did is they made it harder to get the key blanks that you need in order to make keys for the lock. So the lock is just as secure or insecure as it ever has been. It just requires Apple's permission to try and break through it. What the FBI, in effect, wanted access to wasn't the key. They didn't want Apple to break the lock. They wanted Apple to provide them with key blanks that they could use to try and force their way through the lock. So what's the purpose of encryption in this case? Encryption in these cases and on the Apple iPhone and devices like that in particular serve a number of potential uses. The most important use is they protect data from private actors, hackers, people trying to obtain access to a device. Now, the sort of encryption being used in this case really doesn't do a huge amount to protect access to the data on devices, because most attackers are going to use things like malware that will run on the unencrypted device. So that's going to run on the device after the user has entered their PIN. The second really important purpose of encryption in these cases is to protect the device from theft. So if someone steals an Apple iPhone, they would historically be able to brute force their way through the PIN. And once they've done that, they can reset the device and they can resell it. What Apple has done has made it very hard to do that. So they've effectively destroyed the resale market for stolen devices. That is a really important function that this technology serves. The last important thing that this technology does is it protects data from government actors. And this is where things get to be really controversial. This is the crux of the issue in many ways. Does Apple have a legitimate interest in saying how much access governments, including governments going through due process and with legitimate needs and with a warrant, does Apple have a legitimate interest in dictating the level of access that governments are able to get to these devices? And in these cases, you'll hear the concern that once Apple assists the FBI in one of these cases, they'll be compelled to assist the FBI in hundreds of other cases. Heck, they'll be compelled to assist other governments in hundreds of cases. And that's probably true. Now, are we concerned about that? There are reasons to be concerned about that. In the U.S. context, so long as we have Fourth Amendment protections in place and law enforcement's going through appropriate procedures, I think we shouldn't be worried about that. If we are worried about it, the appropriate way to fix it is on the front end, the how does government go about getting a warrant and how do we oversee their execution of that warrant, not on the back end, how does the device comply with the legal requirements. And importantly, this would not jeopardize the protecting the device from theft component of what this sort of encryption is able to do, because while governments would be able to obtain access to this code or Apple's assistance in unlocking devices, Apple would be able to keep that code out of the hands of black market users or criminal users in all likelihood. So I'm going to end there. There are a number of interesting issues that we can get into in questions, and perhaps is a smartphone a phone or a computer? These have historically been treated differently under the law. Well, a smartphone brings these things together on a single platform. There's an important content metadata distinction here, and there's an important empirical question about who actually uses encryption, how do they use it, and for what purpose. And we really need some empirics that don't exist today to inform the normative policy discussion. But I'm going to hand things over to Jamil now to fill things out.
Great. Well, thanks, Gus. And I think that was a great introduction to the topic, and you laid out a lot of the issues that are at stake here. I think, you know, for me, one of the challenges of this debate has been really trying to understand why the two sides haven't found a way to come together and solve this problem. I mean, the reality is that, you know, both sides have very legitimate arguments. Apple has a legitimate and sensible interest in protecting the privacy of its users, and protecting the security of their data on their phones. I mean, look, the reality is that strong encryption is a benefit to us all. It protects our banking transactions. It protects our private emails on the internet. It protects us in a lot of ways that are critical to commerce and the expansion of our economic opportunities using cyber-enabled methods and the Internet of Things and the like. At the same time, the government has a very real and legitimate interest in protecting the nation against terrorists and protecting individuals against criminal threats, and obtaining information when they have a lawful court order and a warrant from a federal court, and getting access to information. So two very legitimate interests, and two that should be able to be reconciled, and yet the Apple iPhone controversy is a good example of where these interests weren't able to be reconciled, and the two sides ended up at odds, and I think we actually had an outcome that's actually dramatically worse for privacy than had they found a middle ground. And the reason I say that is now today, so the FBI gets access to this iPhone, which is the work phone of the San Bernardino terrorist who killed 14 people. The owner of that phone, San Bernardino County, says, we're going to consent to your access to it. However, it's locked and it is unable to be opened by the government because not only does it have a protection feature, this version of iOS has the limitation that if you try the password more than a certain number of times, 10 times, the phone will get automatically wiped if that feature is enabled. And as you try passwords more often, it takes longer and longer to try and get in. And so even if the FBI wanted to try and brute force the phone, it couldn't because it would be wiped. And I actually think the analogy is a little different than Gus described it, key blanks and the like, because I think what's really going on here is that the FBI has all the keys it wants, got the skeleton keys, sort of janitor's keychain of keys on its belt buckle. But what's happened is after 10 tries, the company that made the phone, Apple, has decided to super glue the lock shut. And there are good reasons to do that. If a bad guy gets the phone, you don't want him to be able to try it a million times to break in. But the ability to disable that feature remotely or by the company or whatever is a feature that's necessary if you're going to allow the government to have access to it and still have strong encryption protection for the end user. But Apple isn't willing to put that provision in place because they're concerned about the privacy of their users as against the government. But, of course, the problem is that choice isn't Apple's to make. That choice, and we've decided to put that choice in the hands of federal judges. The person stands between you and me and the federal government, and a search warrant is a federal judge appointed to life terms, appointed by the president, confirmed by the Senate to a life term, protected in theory from political influence by that life appointment. And we've, for the last 200 years of our country, that's been the protection. Not some private company stealing the lockup after 10 tries. It's for that federal judge. And when that federal judge issued that order, it doesn't matter if you're Ben Franklin and it's your desk drawer and all your papers or your underwear drawer, the government can get in once it has a lawful court order. And the same obvious for the Apple iPhone or whatever other device that's the modern equivalent of Ben Franklin's iPhone. And yet, Apple has decided on its own for a variety of good, very good privacy reasons and for a variety of very good security reasons and for a variety of very good business reasons to not permit that and to fight that. And what ends up happening is now you have a situation where the government now is forced to go find a private company, get a hack that's going to be able to get into the phone. So now that phone is insecure, and so is every other phone that has that variety of iOS and is that model. That's insecure as against the government, and as against anybody else that that private sector company that gave the government that hack might sell that hack to. And here's the worst part. Apple will never learn of what that hack is unless it finds out on its own, because the government is not going to give it to Apple. The government has a procedure for assessing whether it should disclose the vulnerability to Apple or not. One of the balancing factors in that test is, what's the harm to national security? And in a scenario where Apple has stamped its feet and said, never, 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 we're going to do everything we can to keep the government out of our phone for a variety, again, of very good reasons, but we're going to do everything we can to keep out and not cooperate in any way, shape, or form, you ensure that the balance always goes in favor of the government, keeping the information away from Apple and not limiting that vulnerability. That means that today, every person in the world, every American who has an iPhone of that vintage, with that version of iOS, is vulnerable not only to private sector actors that this company might sell it to, but to the government without a warrant. So essentially, Apple not only has put itself in the place of a court and opting itself out of the Fourth Amendment bargain that we all made when we created the Constitution, but also it's created incentive for the government to go hack its way into phones and not disclose that information, and thus making us all vulnerable to government independent action without a court in between, and without Apple's ability to break in. And so I think that's a bad outcome for privacy, and not one that's advisable. And so I don't think the right answer is impose mandates upon Apple. I also think the answer is all surveillance all the time for the government. I think the answer is somewhere in the middle, and it's got to be a compromise. These companies and the government sit down together and negotiate. And part, I think, the challenge today, and I'll end on this, is that you have a situation where the government on one end and the privacy groups are on the other at polar opposite ends. And that's not surprising. That's a healthy tension and a healthy debate we ought to have. The problem today is that the companies were normally in the middle of this debate and usually create that lever that moves back and forth and that creates that lever between privacy and security, have found themselves increasingly lockstep with the privacy groups on one side, unable to detach themselves, and as a result, that lever doesn't get moved, and now you have bad outcomes, because now you've got two sides in polar opposite places unable to come to an agreement. What needs to happen is for the companies to realize that there are important reasons for them to find a middle ground, including the bad outcomes I just described, and to start shifting that lever back in the middle as opposed to on one side or the other of the debate. So with that, what should we do? Questions?
Hey, thank you, Professor Jafter. This is Will Courtney back at FedSoc. We're going to open the floor for questions now, I think, and while we wait to see who queues up, I think we'll let Professor Hurwitz respond to anything that he might want to from your remarks. But we are going to open the floor for questions now. In a moment, we're all going to hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. After that, to request the floor, enter star, then the pound key.
Yeah, I'll just offer a couple of brief responses. The most important is that I pretty much agree with everything that Jamil just said. We are in a worse position and will continue to be in an increasingly bad position until the two sides come together and come up with a standardized approach, which is going to require some compromise from both sides. We hear concerns about the so-called going dark concern. That is a bit overstated. It's not entirely overstated. There are lots of other sources of data that we have with all these devices that law enforcement has, but they also are losing access to other important types of data. And a lot of the ideas about how to work with encryption to give government access to encrypted information at a technological level don't make sense. But there are possibilities and there are ways to come to some level of, not really compromise, but some level of standardized approach to, for instance, what information needs to be maintained in unencrypted form, or different levels of protection for different sorts of information. And these conversations, unfortunately, are not happening in the public debates on Capitol Hill right now, and that's a real problem.
Well, our lines are still wide open for questions now. If you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts on any of the many issues we've gotten into today, please do hit star and then the pound key. While we wait to see if anyone is going to ring in with a question, I want to make a quick commercial announcement. Our next scheduled Teleforum conference call is next Friday, June 3rd. We're going to be talking about the ABA's model rules of conduct and free speech issues. The reason we have no calls scheduled between now and then is that we have left days open next week to discuss anything that might occur on Monday at the Supreme Court. So please check our schedule and our email announcements Monday afternoon to see what coverage we have for the Supreme Court there. We still don't have any questions on the line. You can be the first one to ask a question by hitting star and pound, and we'll put you on right away. And we do have one now, so we'll go to that first caller. If you'd like to be next in line at any point, please hit star and then the pound key.
A couple of details I don't quite understand. The stuff they were trying to get was the metadata, as I understand it, the metadata of who he was calling. Wouldn't that information have been available from the telephone company that was the provider?
So sure. I think absolutely the information would be available from the provider, but it's not just about who he was trying to call. Well, one, obviously, as you know, the metadata program has changed significantly. And today the government doesn't store that metadata. The private sector does, and some companies keep it for long periods. Some companies keep it for shorter. So the government could go to those companies. It's also hard for the government to get all the metadata because they've got to go to multiple providers. But yes, in theory, the metadata is available. But that's not the only thing. There could be files on there. There could be text messages. There could be there's a lot of content stuff that you'd want off of that phone. Favorites, web page browse, all things that are on a smartphone that you'll never get through metadata. So sure, the government get the metadata, but when you have a known terrorist cell phone, a guy that's killed 14 people, owned by the government of San Bernardino, that's consent to the search, why do we think it's a good idea for a private sector third party that has no real role in the situation at all to make the decision the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply to them or to this phone, and they can opt themselves out of it? That's what, to me, doesn't make a lot of sense.
And there are different types of metadata. I want to say there's metadata, then there's metadata. So call information metadata for calls made through the public switch telephone network using the device as a telephone, much of that information might be available through the telecommunications carrier. But there's a lot of other contact-related information. So records, first, just the contact list, what phone numbers were in the device that could have been called or that were there for this phone that they were interested in. There are a lot of non-telephone voice communication services and other forms of communications platforms that don't rely on the telecommunications network writ large that the FBI would have wanted to know, hey, was this person using Google Hangouts to talk with people? Was this person using FaceTime to talk with people? That sort of metadata you would only be able to get off of the phone, or you could get off the phones of the counterparties to the communications, but you need to know who those counterparties are.
If there's not another question, I'll step in with another one as well. It seems to me that had the Second Amendment been honored, we wouldn't be having this particular Fourth Amendment problem because the massacre would not have been as successful because the victims wouldn't have been disarmed.
So the response that I will offer to that is not really a response. That's a great Second Amendment issue to discuss and bring up beyond my area of expertise. But there is a discussion that encryption is a form of ARM. And historically, encryption was developed as a technology of war. It was developed by the military primarily throughout history. It was classified as a munition. And there are Second Amendment arguments being made that individuals have a Second Amendment right to use encryption in order to secure themselves from a hostile government, just as they would have a right to keep and bear other forms of arms. I don't expect that that's going to get any traction in the courts, but it is an interesting argument in this context that is made.
Yeah, I agree.
Well, our lines are wide open right now. If you'd like to ask a question, please hit star and then the pound key. Professors, do either of you have a comment that you may have left out of your opening remarks that you'd like to bring up now?
Yeah, I'll
jump. Go ahead, Jamil. You should go ahead, Gus. No, go ahead, Gus. I don't have anything. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say, and the question actually really makes this distinction. I expect that the direction we're going to go in this space is to come up with some form of content metadata distinction. Historically, across every part of ECPA, every part of the compelled wiretapping and recordation of communications regime, we've made a distinction between the content of a communication and the metadata of information about the content of the communication. And I expect in the long run, we're going to end up in a place where device providers who offer turnkey end-to-end systems are going to be under some obligation to keep the metadata in some accessible form for law enforcement purposes, but the contents will be encryptable. The fight then will be along two dimensions. The technology for making that happen will be the technical debate, but I think the really hard debate will be what is the metadata that companies need to make available. And it's important to understand there's a diversion ratio here. The argument that's made is that those bad actors who want to be protected from government surveillance, they will opt into unregulated communications platforms that are not the turnkey end-to-end systems provided at mass market scale. So the government won't be able to get access to their communications. Of course, that's the case today. So that's not a substantial loss for law enforcement, though it makes law enforcement's job always difficult.
Well, we have no questions on the line here. Professor Jaffer, do you have a closing thought?
Look, I mean, I think probably part of the reason we don't have that many questions is because Gus and I agree on too much, unfortunately, on this call. But look, there are a lot of arguments being made out there in public about the absolute need for privacy and the absolute need for strong encryption, and the government should never have access. And, you know, these are non-controversial arguments. In fact, I would say that the arguments that are made on that side of the debate are probably ones that are the most sort of, I think, that have sort of the most purchase, at least here in Washington, D.C., today in sort of the policy circles and in the administration at the White House. And those are the arguments that are winning the debate. And so if what you've heard on this call today from me and from Gus and some of the questions are things that you think are important, I think that it's incumbent upon you know, folks on this call to talk about these issues and get other points of view out there, because there is really a lot of an echo chamber going on this issue in particular, and about this debate going forward. And this is not a debate that's going to go away. As Gus points out, this is a long, historic debate that goes back to the crypto wars of the 90s, and it will continue to be debated, and it should be. I mean, there are the answers are not obvious in this area, and there are important civil liberties and privacy protections that are important for us as you know, members of federal society. We can and should be skeptical of overweening government power. At the same time, we also believe that there's an important role for government to play in national security and the protection of the security of individual Americans. And it's finding that balance that's important. I mean, as this debate goes forward, if you know, people of good conscience and right mind don't speak out and express the both sides of this debate, we unfortunately may run into a scenario where the default answer is you know, what I believe to be one that is overly tilted in one direction or the other. And so I think it's important we continue to have these debates, we have an open and honest conversation, and that we all, members of federal society, and our friends, and those out there who aren't members of federal society on the other side of these debates, are able to express their views and these issues openly and get out there and have an active conversation. So thanks all for listening, and I'll hand it back over to you or to Gus if there are any further comments.
We actually did pick up one question here, as graceful as that conclusion was, but I let's answer this one question before we adjourn.
Okay. Wouldn't it also be the government's responsibility to have maybe the best hackers so that they would be one step ahead of technology from phone companies like Apple?
No, that's an argument that's made. And at some level, I'm sympathetic to it. The problem with it is, let's not use the term hackers. Let's use the term cryptographers, because that's the specific field of hacking that we're dealing with, or the specific area that we're dealing with. This is a very valuable in-demand skill set. And, you know, I would much prefer that the $500,000 a year expert cryptographers that the government could hire to assist them in this area, I prefer that they work out in Silicon Valley developing new, better, more secure platforms and technologies, and that they work with the government, or they work in tandem with the government to develop these technologies in ways that don't frustrate legitimate law enforcement needs. It seems to me like a terrible misallocation of resources to say, hey, you folks who could be out in Silicon Valley developing really powerful, important, cool, socially beneficial technologies, why don't you spend your career in D.C. Helping us fight with Silicon Valley instead? There absolutely is a need for more understanding of the technology in D.C., in law enforcement, in all of these discussions.
Also, are you trying to, is it possible that there are people in the military that could possibly have hacked the phone? Because if a phone company is able to get keep their communication secret from the government, wouldn't the other governments be able to outsmart the FBI or terrorist organizations, for example, Saudi Arabia maybe, keep their communication secret from the FBI?
Jamil, do you want to handle that one? You might be in a better position, I think, than I am.
So could you give me the question one more time? I apologize.
Basically, shouldn't someone in the security, the national security, agencies, the DOD, the DOJ, all these different departments, shouldn't they have at least someone who's able to break through? Because if not, what's keeping other, what's keeping the military men and women safe? If the government can't break into an iPhone, why would the government be able to break into another country's encrypted devices?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, the some people have debated this question and said, well, maybe the reason why it's only the FBI out there saying this and not the NSA, and the NSA actually sort of taking a pass on this whole Apple iPhone thing, is because they have some amazing ability to break encryption and they can do it, and they just don't want to tell anybody. I tend to think that's less true. At least my experience with the intelligence community suggests that while they do have very advanced capabilities, these are hard problems, and the stronger the encryption, the harder it gets. And it's a constant race. And while we have some of the best supercomputers in the world, and we spend a lot of time breaking encryption, when you have a scenario where the most widespread devices, right, the Apple iPhone, the Google Android phones, when they're all employing completely unbreakable, strong encryption with no methodology at all for government access. In fact, in a scenario where those companies decide intentionally to throw away the keys and to set up the phone in such a way that even if the government tried all the keys possibly, it couldn't get in, you make it a very tough situation. And then it means that the government, to the extent it wants to try and get into these phones, has to try with the most ubiquitous phones out there. If you narrow the scope of what the government's going after to, and you push sort of these criminals and these hackers and these terrorists to smaller platforms overseas and the like, people said, well, that'll make it harder. Actually, it makes it easier, right? The more you chase the bad guys into corners, the more likely they are to make mistakes, the more capable you are of concentrating your limited resources and people on those narrower areas. And so I'm less concerned about their use of European providers or Telegram or WhatsApp or whatever it might be, because if you're able to find a way forward with American companies, you've taken the primary methodology off the table. So I actually think you're right to say that we need that capability. The question is only how do you do it? How do you do it through a lawful method where a court is involved or a judge is involved or a third party is involved to ensure the government's doing the right thing? Because, again, as I said, we should be skeptical of overweening federal government power too.
Yeah, and we need to remember we're concerned about obtaining access to different sorts of information from different types of sources. So if we have a turnkey mass scale, very secure technology that allows all potential bad actors to converge on that one platform, then ordinary run-of-the-mill criminals up through the chain, all the way up to your gang kingpins and your drug lords, all the way to your foreign intelligence actors, all the way to your terrorists, they're all on an equally strong platform. Today, the sophisticated parties that we're concerned about, yeah, they can develop those technologies and or they can use other forms of communication, steganography, where it's very difficult for us to intercept or identify their communications. The problem in many ways here is the low-hanging fruit. That's what's changing. Your ordinary run-of-the-mill criminal investigation is being interfered with in these cases. The national security investigations, they've always been hard and always will be hard. This on the margin, these technologies make them harder, but the vast majority of ordinary criminal cases are made a lot harder by these technologies. So we need to understand the different types of investigations that we're concerned about and how each of them is affected by these technologies.
All right, with that, I think we've reached the end of the call here. Anything else you want to say before we conclude, either of our speakers? Sounds like a no. But thank you both for dialing in. I know you both had some tricky circumstances in being able to join us today, so we appreciate that you were able to make time for us. To our audience, our next scheduled call is next Friday, but we will almost certainly be adding more calls earlier next week to cover developments at the Supreme Court. So I invite you to check our website to stay abreast of those developments. But until next week, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everybody.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.